Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. Today I'm joined by my girlfriend, Juliana. Say hello.
Hello.
And we're going to be talking about a book that we actually finished reading. Well, let's tell the story of this book. So we saw this movie in the video shop because we live just like 300 meters away from a video store where we rent lots of movies and Blu-rays. And we saw this one, which is called Cloud Atlas. And I was like, hey, we should watch that. But then I'd heard it was really long and not that accessible and things. And I thought, well, let's read the book first. Or did you say let's read the book first?
Yeah.
So anyway, we decided that we'd read the book and then watch the movie. And then I was like, because I'd seen the trailer, I thought, well, it's kind of sci-fi, isn't it? I'm not sure. Well, you know, because like in the movie trailer for Cloud Atlas, there's, you know, spaceships flying around. And
I have not really seen the trailer.
It starts off with there's a big antenna on top of the hill that they have there. It starts with that opening, and then it cuts to Neo Sol like super far future, you know, cityscapes with people flying around shooting each other. And then it goes, and then there's a ship and stuff. Anyway, people who know the movie or know the book understand what we're getting at here. But the point is that, I was thinking, is this science fiction or not? And I decided, well, it doesn't matter if it's science fiction or not. It's certainly eligible to be reviewed here on the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast because it says at the top, It won the British Book Awards Literary Fiction Award and the Richard and Judy Book of the Year. Blah, blah, it doesn't matter because that's all a literary award. It says, was shortlisted for the 2004 Booker Prize, Nebula Award, and Arthur C. Clarke Award, and other awards. So if something is nominated for a Nebula Award or the Arthur C. Clarke Award, it means that that's good enough to be classed as science fiction.
That was actually the biggest problem I had when I found out, okay, I'm going to read that.
You thought it was a science fiction book?
No, and I went to Goodreads.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, I was not sure on which bookshelf to put it.
Yeah.
And then I asked you, is it science fiction? And you said, oh, yeah, it is. And then I started listening to it, and I thought, no. What? No, that's not science fiction.
Yes, I know, but I misunderstood your question. Like, when you said, is it science fiction? I thought you were meaning, are we going to review this on the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast? And which, of course, is the answer is yes. Is it science fiction? Is a different question.
But it is a difficult question to that book.
I think it contains science fiction and contains enough science fiction elements to be eligible to be discussed on a Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. But I would understand if some people said it isn't science fiction, other people said it is science fiction. Personally, I think it is science fiction because, like, it kind of builds up to a science fiction finale or middle. Well, I say finale. Anyway, the structure of the book is difficult enough to get through. But it's like saying, there's a movie and it starts off, and for the first half of it, you don't realise what's going on. I can't remember what the movie was called, but I think it was one with Charlie Sheen. And all the way through at the beginning, you think, it's a movie about a guy and an event. Oh, and you're like, it is about aliens. It's about aliens. And then you're like, so this is science fiction then. You know, it's like one of those things that just because the first quarter of the book or the first third of the book isn't science fiction, it kind of builds up to a science fiction conclusion. Yeah. However, again, but I understand this is...
I would just call it fiction.
Anyway, should we even tell people that we read this book and who is it by and stuff?
Okay.
The book is Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. It was written in... published in first... was it 2004? It's a literary novel, as you could see, because it's all about literature, blah blah blah. It's all about live people and stuff.
Why are you switching to this kind of voice?
I'm just saying that, like, when people talk about, is it science fiction or is it literary fiction? And I like the idea of that kind of distinguish, like, to separate the two. I just think is
that's a bit weird.
But I understand
why
people
call it fiction.
It's just fiction, but it is. But because it's very much metafiction, it's fiction about the fiction you're reading. It's a fiction where people know that they're in a book, or well, maybe this single characters don't know they're in the book, but it's stated that some of the characters in the book are fictional, but you read them anyway. So I understand all the am I reading literature? Am I reading science fiction? Kind of thing. What are you? You're not typing anything. Oh, your computer's running slow. So we've both got our laptops over here on the Wikipedia page for Cloud Atlas. Oh yeah, and after we listened to the audiobooks, it took a while for us to get through the audiobooks. And then I went away for a work trip for 8 or 9 days.
Yeah.
And Juliana had trips to hospital and stuff. But then finally, last night, we finished, we watched it.
Yeah,
we watched Cloud Atlas.
We watched the last bit.
We watched the first like 30, 40 minutes of the movie, and then yesterday finished off the movie. And yeah, so Cloud Atlas. Shall we talk about the setup, the world?
The book.
Yeah. So this, the Cloud Atlas is set in like a fictionalized version of our world.
Yes.
In which...
although it's only partly fiction.
Well, the point
some
is that...
some things are actually... because I just looked it up.
Yeah.
Some parts are actually really...
well, it's based in reality.
True things.
It's like parts of it are historical fiction, parts of it are contemporary fiction, parts of it are science fiction,
yes.
Parts of it are post-apocalyptic, you know, fiction.
It's
you know,
a good combination of pretty much every kind of fiction.
Yeah. So the way it starts is sailing. It starts off with the Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing, and Adam Ewing is a solicitor, a lawyer who has been sent from San Francisco across to New Zealand to get something signed, like to get some deeds signed or whatever it is, and because he's a notary public, and then so he's sailing back from New Zealand. And he starts off in the Chatham Islands, and there's slaves there and stuff, and he sets off, and he's sailing back then. And then stuff happens along the way, which I don't want to go into too deeply here, but then the story just cuts off, like, mid-sentence.
Yes. I was wondering, whoa, what's going on? Because I listened to... We both listened to it as an audiobook, and yeah. I thought, well, what happened there? Is there something wrong with the audiobook?
No.
I really checked it, and I went back to the chapter before, and then I listened to it again, and I thought...
No, well, it really
actually
does,
really is as it is. It
just really
cuts,
just cuts
off. And
So, but it actually says here on the English Audible version, note to customers, the complicated format of this novel makes it seem that the audio may be cutting off before the end of a story, accompanied by a change in narrator. However, this is the author's intention, so please continue to listen and the stories will conclude themselves as intended. You know,
that's a little note from
David Mitchell or, you know, is from Random House Audio.
I'm sure if you read the book... it might seem...
because you can just look at the page number going from one to the other.
Yes, and there's probably like an index, maybe.
But I understand why people get confused, because I have read books where there's suddenly just the last point missing. I think I've mentioned this before about the Heinlein novel, Stranger in a Strange Land, the copy that I had. Just the last pages, like the last section, like the last 12 or 15 pages, were just missing from the book, so I didn't read them. And I've never read them, so I've never actually read those last few pages of Stranger in a Strange Land.
So you actually know... by your own experience, how it feels like
how it feels
what
like
these
you
people
get,
went
you just
through.
Get to it and you're, what's good? But this was after already reading the whole of the book, and then there's like a section missing at the end. So yes, I can understand that. So then the next story sets up. Oh, and that's like it says, it's called the Pacific Journal. So this is all journal style. I did this today. This day I did this, and I've been thinking this recently.
Also, Mr. Ewing, Adam Ewing, he's ill.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to talk more about the structure rather than the individual stories.
Okay.
We'll get onto the individual stories because then we can talk about how they connect together later on. Okay. The next one is called Letters from Zedelheim.
Zedelheim,
which is from Belgium. So it's and this is a young musician flees England and goes over. His name is Robert Frobisher. And Robert Frobisher flees England and is sending letters back to his, it says, his old friend and lover, Rufus Sixsmith, who's going to be important later on. And Frobisher, he gets involved with this family of a composer. What's his name? The Ayres? What was his name? Vivian Ayres. And he becomes his... What's the name?
Assistant.
Amanuensis or something is the word that they use. Really? Amanuensis. I think it's amanuensis, which was a word I've heard before. But anyway, he's there, this guy who's... Vivian Ayres is kind of blind, and he's writing this music, and he needs someone to write the music down for him. So it's like a composing assistant.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth, gets involved with the wife, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so as we're getting through here, Robert Frobisher is saying, oh, I read this book, and this book is called... The Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing, you know, and he says, but they are not quite sure. It seems like this is happening in the book, this is happening. But it seems like it's probably fiction, you know, it's probably just like a novel told in journal style, in the same way that, you know, you read the start of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And it starts off and it's like, oh, I have a letter and I do this, and then inside of this, I'm going to send you this journal. And it's that same kind of letters within journals within frame stories kind of thing going in that you have at the beginning of Frankenstein and these other novels. So it kind of fits in with writing from The you know, from 1950s, like the whole frame story is like, oh, and I've met this guy and he did this, yeah, and he told me this thing, you know, all of these, pretty much every time I review a science fiction novel or any novel on this podcast from before, you know, before the 20th century, all has frame stories, you know, like the time machine, oh, and I spoke to this guy and he came in here and he told me this, and all that kind of stuff, and like the Invisible Man. Another one is sort of like, that's all journal style. Yeah, I did this, that kind of thing. I've been doing this. Yeah.
And so also the second part, the Letters from Sedelchem, is taking part in 1931 in Belgium.
Yes.
And the Pacific Journal is in 1850.
Yeah.
So
it's a big skip forward.
Yeah. But then, of course, when it's mentioned that Frobisher read the journal, yeah, of Adam Ewing, and yeah, then we found out, oh, he only has half of the book.
Yes.
Because the book is ripped in two halves.
And he can't find the other half.
The other half. This is why,
yeah,
the first bit of the first Adam Ewing,
yeah,
story just ends like out of nothing.
Yeah. So the next part,
it's really clever. It's really clever that you have these connections, and then you also have the connection of the overall book.
Yeah.
Why the story, yeah, just cuts off.
Yeah, so on to the next one, the same kind of thing. Letters from Sedelchem. We get to the end of a letter.
It's called Sedelchem.
Sedelchem.
It's not so difficult.
Sedelchem. And then, so then we cut to Half-Lives, the first Louisa Ray mystery, part one. So yeah, we get the first half of it says here on Wikipedia, the mystery thriller novel set in the fictional city of Buenos Aires, California.
1975.
Yes,
Which is why they're smoking so much pot in it.
What they're smoking pot and they're hanging out, and it's really, and I actually really I quite like the setting of you know, Buenos Aires.
Yeah.
And this is very much like it's sort of like, you know, mystery thriller novel, but the whole setup of this one is very like, it reminds me a lot of a movie which I watched called China Syndrome, and I think it's, you know, it's kind of like the Three Mile Island kind of thing, where there's going to be a nuclear disaster and there's one woman reporter who goes in there and gets all sorted out.
Yeah, the story, it seems to be very familiar.
Of course, all of these stories are very familiar.
It seems like a story that you've read before.
Yeah.
Like all the other stories, you have the feeling that's something you've read before.
Of course.
And this makes it so fun to be connected in one book.
So, yeah, we read that first half of the novel. Oh, this is like Half-Lives, and it's kind of presented as just quite a straight novel. This is the one that's most obviously fiction, or written most obviously,
yes,
as fiction.
Yes.
Like, that, as you're reading it, you go, okay, there's like if you're reading like a journal in first person, you're like, okay, this can be a fictional journal, it can be a real journal. And if you're reading like letters, you can go, these can be fictional, you know, letters or not fictional letters.
Yeah.
Whereas when you write, this is a novel, you're like, okay, this is fiction. And then the other ones, like you're reading, so we get the first half of that. And then the next one is the ghastly ordeal of Timothy Cavendish.
Oh,
and
this, we should also mention that in the story of Louisa Ray,
yeah,
the second main character in that one
is Sixsmith,
who is the love interest,
yes,
of Adam Frobisher.
Yeah.
So this is the connection between,
yes,
these two.
And Louisa Ray finds half of the letters from Sedelchem, half of the letters that are sent from
Sedelchem. Yeah.
She finds them and reads, and within the course of the first half of the Louisa Ray mysteries novel, she, yeah, reads half of the letters. Anyway, so then we get to the ghastly ordeal of Timothy Cavendish, and this is, again, it's kind of very much of a fictional like novel, but because it's told in first person, it's like, I'm doing this, and I'm doing,
yeah,
this, and I'm doing this, you know, because it's like a fictionalized, you know, fictionalized, serialized memoir, so it's kind of diary-like, but is, you know, told much more in the past tense,
yeah,
rather than, not like a daily past tense, but like a continuous past tense, but, so, yes, this is a guy who gets sent up, and he's a publisher, isn't he? He's like
he's a publisher. He's a
vanity
self-writing authors.
Yeah,
like,
self-published authors. He's a vanity publisher.
Yeah.
So the way that it works is people pay him money to print his book, and then they sell the book. But he also gets the copyright of the book. So once he suddenly gets this big,
he always has ten or 20 of these printed.
Yeah,
it's not like you have like hundreds of them. what he does.
Yeah.
Because he, authors come to him to get their stuff published for friends and family.
Yes, so it's
You have like a total, how do you call it when a book...
Like a run.
When you print books and then you have like so many
editions.
Books. Yeah, you have an edition of, let's say, 30 books.
Yes.
This is normally what he does.
Yes, but this one person that comes to him gets him to publish like a few thousand books or something like that, and then they're not selling. Anyway, through various reasons, this book becomes a big hit, but then there's a copyright claim. Again, I don't want to get too much into it because there's no reason to spoil all the really like funny stuff that goes on here. Yes. Anyway, with a copyright claim, almost a criminal copyright claim, Timothy Cavendish's brother says, "Hey, I can help you out. Go here and hide up at this hotel." And he's like, "Okay." Yeah. And then when he gets there,
and his way there is really funny as well. Yeah. He has some fun.
But it's a fun like travel adventure thing.
Yeah.
It's an old guy trying to get to Hull from London, but it becomes an adventure in the same level as the adventure of Adam Ewing going across the Pacific. You know, it becomes a big thing that he learns it on the way and things he confronts his past on the way. And then he ends up in this hotel, which we might as well spoil a little bit here, but it turns out this hotel isn't a hotel. It's actually a nursing home, and he signs himself into a nursing home by accident, not realizing.
It's something that you can imagine.
But it's
imagine.
So obvious he's when like, you're reading the book, you know what's going to happen when
like,
he gets
at
there.
At the end, he's like a bit confused, and he's in it. It's late and cold and dark, and so he comes into that hotel happy to be there.
Yes,
and then he signs something where he thinks he's just signing. He's signing himself into the hotel, like the registration.
Yeah, the
papers.
Hotel registration.
And then he goes to bed. And then he wakes up again.
And now he's trapped. And what we have here, like we've had like, you know, the journal stuff. We've had the musical event, you know, the adventure of the musician.
Yes.
And like, which is, again, that's kind of like, what's the, was it the portrait of a young man as an artist? What's the, you know, the kind of like, oh, I'm a tortured soul as an artist. You know, one of those like
Dorian
novels. That kind of thing. You know, it feels very much like, you know, in the 1930s, an exploration of, you know, what's it like to be a tortured young artist, that kind of thing. Louisa Ray is very kind of straight thriller mystery. Whereas, like, but I'm talking about the stories that are contained within them. This is very
much we had one flew over a cuckoo's nest. We had a journal. A journal by Adam Ewing.
Yeah.
We had letters from Frobisher, and we had what else did we have?
What the novel, the mystery novel?
Yeah. How was this? This is more, this is more like a straight novel. This
But what I'm saying is more of the story contained within them. Like you say, these are stories that I've heard before. Everything seems very familiar. This seems very familiar if you've ever seen or read One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest. I mean, isn't it Nurse Noakes?
Noakes is
Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest. And again, I don't want to touch on get into the movie too much straight away. Is that
I haven't seen it.
Yeah. No, I'm saying in the movie of Cloud Atlas that we watched yesterday, they pretty much just copied Nurse Ratched. You know, the character in both of them is like very much the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's drawing directly from there. So again, when you think, oh, I've seen this before, someone incarcerated against their will in a home. Yes, we've seen this before. Then we start moving because the ghastly ordeal of Timothy Cavendish is kind of present day. I think in the movie it was set in 2004.
Yeah, it is like,
and I guess that's when the book was written.
Yes.
So then,
but also you have to mention that before he's fleeing London.
Oh yeah, he gets the first half of the manuscript.
He has got a
Louisa Ray mystery,
and then he takes it with him. It's another
manuscript.
It's a manuscript called Half Lives, the first Louisa Ray mystery.
Yes.
Which then also, of course, Half Lives gets back to Louisa Ray's story.
Yeah.
And
Moving on, our next section is an orison of Somni 451. And this says here, the fifth story is set in Neo-So-Corpros, a dystopian futuristic state that is gradually revealed to be in Korea. And to be a totalitarian state that has evolved from corporate culture. This is called a corpocracy, which I always love these science fictional names for. Like we get the democracy and all these other, you know, these are the things. But I really like these new words for like technocracy.
New word finding stuff.
Yeah.
Because I'm also currently reading 1984 again.
Yes.
This reminds me a lot of it.
Yes.
This is like this constructing of new new words for something.
So Somni451 is a genetically engineered fabricant. She's a clone, and they are grown in a tank, and then to work, just to work generally, you know,
just the whatever clones, they are,
whatever they need to be done
need to be do,
and doing. And all the young girl clones are used as servants and waitresses and cleaners and stuff,
for
and
kids.
Nurses for kids and all that kind of stuff. And the men clones, we don't actually see any in this movie, but it's I'm presuming the idea is the men clones do the heavy lifting, the heavy work, and like the heavy slave labor.
Yeah.
Although I don't think it's actually made that clear. So she works in a fast food restaurant, like McDonald's,
Papa Song's.
And yeah, and it's a story of, hey, I'm a clone, but am I human on the inside? What's it really mean to be human? Blah, 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 that kind of stuff.
And what does it mean to be a clone?
Yeah.
Does that mean, but because you're a clone, you're not human?
Yes.
And you have no feelings, and you have no, not a right to have your own life. That's the main question of it. And this story reminded me so much of the movie The Island. Luke hasn't seen it, but this is so much... The whole story of The Island is kind of the story of Somni451.
Yes, because all of these stories, it feels like you've read them before somewhere. It feels,
but also they are all like related, kind of this basic idea of the clones being what is a clone and what is a clone worth, and
so we during this story, it's all this is super science fictiony stuff. But
I really enjoyed this
really good
story,
stuff. Yeah. And then it's interrupted as she is something comes and she escapes from this as a help to escape, and you think, what's going on here? There's a bit of this and a bit of that, and then it suddenly goes, somebody were attacked, and
Hey Ju is the
guy who's been young student guy who helped him escape.
Yeah.
He goes, he turns to her and says, I'm more than I said I am. Like that.
And the connection, because every story has the connection to the previous story.
Yeah, she's been watching the movie of The Ghastly Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How funny.
Which is good fun. And then they get interrupted there, and then they have to run and escape and blah 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 like that. So we get to the sixth story, and this one isn't split into two halves because now we're in the middle of the novel, and it's called Sluice's Crossing and Everything After, and it tells the story of Zachary. So we've gone. I mean, this is one of these obvious little tricks that I picked up. We've gone from Adam Ewing to Zachary. So we've gone from A to Z, and we've reached the end of the world. Society has collapsed more than the thing is. The origin of Somni451 seems to be. This is in a dystopia future, but
not
like, it's not quite clear what's going on in the rest of the world.
But it's never said when it takes place.
No, I'm not sure. But it's obviously in the future, and then society and everything collapses, and there's something called the Fall, and what we're left with is people living in Hawaii, trying to get by in Hawaii. And Zachary is an old man telling a story from his youth, saying, "Ah, man, this is what it last used to be like." And he tells this story, once again taking us back, like it's as though we've gone back in time again. And we, because the very start of the story with Adam Ewing, he retells the story of the Maori and the Maori, or whatever they are, these two different...
The Maori and the Maori. Yeah.
Which are these two tribes, which one of them came from New Zealand and one was in the Chatham Islands, where the beginning of the book comes, and the warlike people came in and slaughtered the not-warlike people, and all this kind of stuff.
Which is actually what I just read on Wikipedia. The Moriori, actually, that is actually a true story of the of these two tribes.
Yeah.
Like of the Maori killing the Moriori and stuff, which is also really cool because this makes you like read about it. I've never have read about this folk there.
Yeah.
So these people that actually were living and which actually, so this is this weird confusion that you think, oh, I read this before.
Yeah. And you have read it before,
because
you were actually reading the same kind of story again. Of course, this is now set in post-apocalyptic stuff, but people are still running around with swords. People are running around with swords and killing each other on an island in the Pacific again, even though it's not Chatham Island.
Yeah.
It's in Hawaii. But then there's some people who still have technology, the prescience, And the language by this point has gone so far into the future, because this is another great thing about this, is that the language from 1850 really reads like 1850s language.
Yes.
Even though the next person says, the language seems a bit too florid. It seems like it's a bit too constructed.
Yeah.
But the language really changes. And what's me really liking now is about the Sluices Cross and everything after some, is that it's really good some, and I can't do a thing, but I really enjoyed the performance of this, because it's so much in a language that you wouldn't be able to understand. But once you get into it, once I listened to about 15 minutes of it, I was like, oh, right, I can understand some stuff now.
I'm
me can understand the Stoopy stuff. You said it was a bit like Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah, but because this is only because we just watched it in English. We watched the Cloud Atlas movie in English.
Yeah.
But I listened to it as the audiobook was for me in German.
Yeah.
So that made it really a lot easier for me to understand Zachary, because his dialect for me to understand in English would have been I would just not understand anything on the audiobook. I mean, maybe reading it would have worked somehow, but listening to it as a German audiobook, if you're not native English, you should really try to get your native language reading of that book if you're listening to an audiobook. Or if you read the book, just go with a translation. It is easier if it's closer to your own language, because that is quite challenging.
Yeah. So we have a thing going on there between tribes and the prescience, and Merinim comes in, you know, who's a woman who gets off a ship and stays with Zachary, and they go on an adventure together. Anyway, so that is pretty good. Oh, and also we see in this part of the novel, Somni 451 has become a religious figure, and everyone goes, oh, by Somni, you know, like this. And,
she's like a goddess.
Somni bless you and stuff. And her orison is a recording of her telling her story, which is what we actually get in the orison of...
No, it's actually not telling her story. It is her telling about the society that she lives in.
Yes.
Because Zachary, when he meets Merinim, he sees... In this egg-shaped transmitter, what she has.
Hologram thing.
He's then watching while she's not there. He's secretly watching Somni telling her story.
Yes.
With the archive.
Archivist. So we get connected then, and then he sits down, like, at the end of that story, he's telling the end of his story, he says, and now I only watched half of the Orison of 451, let me sit down now and watch the second half.
Yes.
And then we get the second half of Somni 451 story, and at the end of there, she said, oh, just before I do this, let me just sit down and watch the second half of this movie. What's the movie called? The movie's called The Ghastly Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish. So then we get the second half of the movie of the memoir version of The Ghastly Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish. And during that part where it's telling about his escape from the nursing home, he says, oh, and look, now, like right at the end, it says, oh, look, the other half of the Louisa Ray mystery, Half-Lives, the first Louisa Ray mystery, part two has just turned up.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to sit down and read it and see if I can publish this. Is going to be our next hit.
Yeah.
So then we go back there, we get Louisa Ray finishes of all her stuff, and at the end she goes, oh, Rupert Sixsmith, who got all these letters, here's the rest of... I only read half of his letters, but then Rufus Sixsmith's niece says, oh, here's eight more letters that were also addressed. These are the rest of the letters that you want.
Yeah.
And Louisa Ray is like, oh, great. Well, now let me read them. And then we get the second half of the letters from Zedelheim.
As
Avdin Frobisher is leaving, he goes, oh, and I found the second half of this book.
Yeah, it was trapped under
and
the
before,
bed.
And before he gets to the end of the story, he's like, I will now read the second half of this book. And then we get the second half of the Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing, and then we read that second half of the book. So the structure, how would you describe the structure?
I would describe it as like a pyramid.
As a pyramid?
Yeah, it is like, it goes up and then it goes down.
Down. So we go forward through time and then backwards through time in sections.
What I
love most about this book, or what I thought was genius about this book, is that this book itself is continuously telling us what the author thinks we could be thinking about the book. For example, I can't remember exactly what which times they go. Oh, like, for example, Robert Frobisher is talking about his piece of music that that he's writing, his masterwork, is going to be called The Cloud Atlas. And it's...
This Cloud Atlas Sextet.
And it's going to be six different soloists with six different instruments. One of them will start, and then as he goes along, he'll be then interrupted by somebody else playing a different thing that will kind of go over him and play off the same themes but keep going. And then another one will be doing, so he says, it's a series of solos, a sextet. One picks up after the other, and then we go back through them. And he's saying... Is this going to be genius, or is it going to be? Is it going to be a gimmick? You know, all that kind of stuff. Is like, how is this going to work? And then other people. I think it's one of the guys in the Louise Ray mysteries. I can't remember which of the characters. It's the one who gets blown up on the plane when he's sitting on the plane.
Sax.
That guy. I can't remember his name, but yes, you got the right guy. Anyway, he's going as like, time is... Oh, maybe it's not him, but somebody else mentioned this. He goes, time is not an arrow or a boomerang, but a concertina.
A what?
A concertina.
What's that?
It's a... Like, if you have a piece of... maybe if I just type it... Concertina. If I type it into Google here, you see this, a concertina.
Oh, okay.
It's like a squeeze box kind of thing, but also a concertina. The actual concertina part of an accordion is the zigzaggy paper which goes. It's not just a pyramid. It doesn't just go up and then down again. It's kind of compresses and uncompresses.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? It goes up and then down and up and then down.
Yeah.
Another of the characters says. You know, he's talking about, or maybe this was this guy as well. He goes, each present enclosed by a shell called the past, you know.
Yeah.
And you understand that as you, oh, and another one says, it's a cycle, and we play a gramophone record, and then when it gets to the end, we play the gramophone record again. So while this book only takes us one side up, your pyramid that you're talking about, it takes us up to the top of the pyramid, then down the other side of the pyramid.
Yeah.
The whole point is that it's a cyclical book. That's why it goes from A to Z, but Z is telling the start, the same story from the start again.
Yeah.
And as you read through, you can get back to the end, and then it kind of picks up, you know, you kind of go forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards.
It's this weird kind of loopy thing.
Yes.
Because, it's actually, this wire here actually reminds me a lot more of it. Because the wire is not something that, this wire, just comes up on the Google, it comes on the Google images when you type concertina. And there's this wire.
It's like barbed wire on the top of a prison fence,
But then you have this ongoing loop, which is connected.
Yeah.
And then always goes up and comes down, goes up and comes down. But it also is always connected from the beginning with the end.
Yes, and at different points along the way as well. Yeah,
yes. So the idea of this loopy thing actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, this is a bit more concertina. The idea of a concertina, it doesn't mean so much the musical instrument. It's like the foldedness of the paper.
Ah, okay.
Like, and when you get a concertina...
Like when you have a fan.
Yeah, like with a fan, if you have a bit of paper and the bits of paper, if you pull it out, it just goes up, down, up, down, up, down. But when you squash it together, it becomes like a book that all the sides are touching each other.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the whole trick is like, if you get a piece of paper and draw a spot on the bit of paper and then another spot somewhere else on the bit of paper, it's like, what's the shortest distance between those two spots?
Yeah.
And in classic geometry, you would get a ruler and you'd draw a line between the two spots.
Yeah.
But when you start talking about different dimensions and things, if you pick up the bit of paper, fold the bit of paper in half, and then just put a pen through the spot, you realize, the two points on the pages, the two points on one page can be 0 millimeters apart if you just fold the page. That's what I find with the Cloud Atlas, the novel, is that you would think, this is a long way in time and in the book and in space from this other thing. Away from the other thing. But once you realize you're reading a concertina book, which is sort of like each page can fold back against the other, in a literary kind of way, you realize that there is no distance between any of these characters. There is no difference any of these points.
Also, all the way through, you're realizing other things. You're realizing other little details. Like you wrote down this sixsmith.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, it's quite that's an obvious.
That's an obvious one.
That's an obvious point. Yeah. But then you have other little things that you. I don't really have one in my head now, but there's loads of little connections between the characters and the stories and here and there, and it's just so brilliant, like the just the writing of that book.
Yeah.
It's, I think it's since, like, I don't know since when, but this is one of the literally most advanced or like
what, like as artistic, a meta narrative
artistic kind yeah. of books I've read for yes. a long, long time.
Oh no, it but the thing is, what I think is genius about this is that the characters themselves in the books are David Mitchell talking about this very process.
Yes.
What I love about it is that you know, like Timothy Cavendish works in publishing, and he actually writes down at one point and says, oh, look, yes, we've seen Half Lives of Louisa May. We've seen yeah. this before. But is it just about that, you know, if everything's been done before, yes. you know, nobody can do all the way from, you know, from what does he say, from Aristotle through to, yeah. you know, through to Shakespeare and onwards like that. We're never going to come. It's not the story you're telling. It's how you're telling the yes. story. And I'm like, yes, you get
exactly.
it. And, but also he says, is it a gimmick? Or he even says yeah. at the beginning, it's like, well, you might not like flashbacks and you might not like flash forwards, you might not want like different structure, people playing around with structure in the book. Yeah. What you really might want is just a straight telling. But hey, indulge me for a while, I'm going to do flashbacks and flash forwards and yeah. you know, mess around. He's telling us what he's yes. doing. You know, the characters are wondering, and is this just a gimmick?
But the thing is that the brilliant thing about this book is also that every single story has its own language and its own storytelling, its own style.
Yeah.
So you never think, oh, this is actually just what's his name? David Mitchell? No.
Yeah.
Yeah, David Mitchell.
Yeah.
Telling the story. It is actually, you have the feeling that it's...
It is six people.
Six people.
It reminds me so much of Hyperion, which is also another book yeah. with a frame
yeah,
story.
Right.
And there's like the overall like frame story, but then there's six people telling six different stories. And one of them is a mystery. One of them yeah. like a pulp adventure.
Yeah.
One of them is high science fiction. One of them is an adventure one. You know, it's yeah. very much, I mean, if you're going to compare... to any other novel,
I
think Hyperion is the single closest
yes.
novel, because you get the adventure story, you get
yeah.
the
yeah,
I mean,
right.
I can't remember
that's
the
right.
yeah, you get the priest, like the priest yeah. is very much like the Adam Ewing kind of thing where he's going to
yeah.
be dying and is
and
he
then
dying
you have the,
like
you have
yeah,
the love story.
And he's born again, yeah, you got the love story
yeah.
of the, you know, of the unrequited love. Well, no, it's more of like
yeah.
the Shakespeare, you know, star-crossed
yeah.
lovers kind of thing there.
Yeah.
Where they
yeah,
do actually love each
good,
other.
That's actually a good comparison.
So I think if you've read and enjoyed Hyperion, you'd
yeah.
probably read and enjoy this. The good thing is about this book is that it's way funnier than Hyperion.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like you, I don't want this to come across as, oh, there's a guy on a boat and it's all literary and stuff. It's a very, very playful book. There's at no point in this book, maybe when you first start reading it, when you go, oh, okay, and it's about slaves and it's about a guy. Like
yeah, you
that.
Have
yeah.
to get into it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you have to just be open
yeah.
and go with it.
I listened to the Incomparable podcast, which is a very good podcast by, I can't remember the guy, all of the guys who do it, who was talking about it on there, but they always do, you know, they do lots of, you know, reviews of books and movies and comic books and TV shows and stuff, generally, you know, genre stuff. And they did a discussion of this where three of them read this book and were talking about it. And they said, they led off with, you know, how important it feels and all that kind of stuff, but then they also were doing like what we're doing. Don't think this is a hard read. It's actually, you know, it's very light, it's very enjoyable. There's always fun stuff going on.
Yes.
Although none of them likes the Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing, they thought it was a slog to get into. But once they got into it, they really enjoyed it.
I quite liked it. I quite enjoy this style of
Pacific Journal Adam
yes.
Ewing.
Yeah.
yeah.
But I also read other books that are similar to that.
Yes.
So
yes, you read historical fiction anyway.
I do
yeah.
read historical fiction, and like something like Anne Perry, for example, is
yeah.
pretty similar in
yeah.
in the style.
So we've talked a bit about. Oh yeah, let's talk. There's a few other connections, like you said before, about like on Wikipedia, linking themes. The number six is repeated throughout the novel. So we include the six interlocking stories. The music score, Cloud Atlas, is the sextet with overlapping. We've talked about this. Six Smith is the name of a main character.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the other things which connect these, like literally in the book. One thing that connects them all, which I'm not sure what your opinion of this. A lot of the main characters are described as having a birthmark on them, which looks like a comet.
Yes.
Like a shooting star kind of thing.
Yeah.
I want to say, just a little note about the movie, that wasn't the shape, the way that it is in the movie wasn't the shape that I was expecting at all.
Me neither.
That looked more like that a Christmas decoration shooting star.
Totally like a Christmas shooting star.
Yeah, rather than a comet. But whatever, I don't mind about that. But what I'm saying, like, did you notice that? Of course, that's brought out
of course,
blatantly.
Quite obvious.
But did you enjoy that? Did you like that link between them?
Yeah, it was quite of like a mysterious kind of link because, yeah, sure, why shouldn't people have similar looking birthmarks? Yeah. But this was very specific. And I thought at some point it was a bit too over the top.
Yeah, I think it was a bit over the top because there's this whole thing going, oh, well, when you die, what happened? Well, no, actually, that's more in the movie. But like the whole idea is like, are these people...
Somehow related or
reincarnated, but it can't. Of course, that can't be because Timothy Cavendish and Louisa Ray would have been alive at the same time.
Yes,
and we know that because just the age of Timothy Cavendish would have overlapped with Sixsmith, which would have overlapped with Louisa Ray. We know that kind of stuff, so they're not connected in a spiritual sense. But I thought it was. I thought it was obvious enough which characters were meant to be the repeating characters who are meant to be having similar experiences and learning similar lessons or being on one side or the other side of any situation.
Yes.
One theme that I quite liked is which was very blatant, which is where it begins and ends with, is the whole slavery and servitude and freedom kind of thing.
That's a very big theme of the book, slavery and freedom
in
all kinds of... which is really interesting to read all these different points of views on it.
Yeah,
because you have this totally different view on it in the historical style. You have the view on it in the 1930s or like in just a work relation style.
Well, he's even talking. Robert Frobisher was is this what servants feel like? Because I've never been a servant. I've always been, I'm a toffee mouthed this guy, born with a silver spoon in my mouth and blah blah blah. And now I'm living in a house and I'm working. But it's good that the servant. And even though he is still a servant, he doesn't acknowledge his place as a servant, but talks himself as above the other servants, which he is in some ways. Because he's more highborn or whatever you want to say like that. And he's talking about that. Now, the one part of this book, which I actually think was actually my least favourite while listening to it as an audiobook, was the Louisa Ray mysteries, which is weird because on this incomparable incomparable podcast was that they said that the Louisa Ray mystery was one of their favourite parts. And I thought that was the one which was a bit, was the least convincing. Like, when as that was written, it was like, oh, and then I read these letters and I wanted to listen to this music. That felt the least connected. And also, like, what was that doing in there? Like, what did that have to do with the other themes? The themes of these other ones with being in captivity and slavery and trying to get out of that kind of stuff was really strong.
This is more about the truth coming out. This is more about freedom of truth.
Yes, but I'm just not interested in the truth.
Exactly. And that's probably your point why you didn't enjoy that so much. But I think it fit. I think it did fit.
It fit and it was kind of a link, but like almost in a way... I don't think I would have... Like, if the Louisa Ray mystery wasn't in the book, I don't think I would have missed it.
I can understand that, but because I do, like, criminal investigations kind of stories.
Yeah, like the thriller mystery stuff.
I did enjoy this book, this part. The only part that was a bit weird was the part that who was on whose side was a bit... played too much into it was a bit too
conspiracy
that was a bit too deep and at some points a bit too
The only thing that I can think of that in there was like when she goes into the room and there's the people like make it was in the teddy bear factory or something like that and that kind of played into it a bit but wasn't really strong enough, but that was
a very fun thing to listen to that to that bit of the story was just hilarious.
Yeah, and also in that book, she goes down to see the yacht, and she goes past the Chatham? No, the boat he was going on. Maybe it's not mentioned here. Anyway, he's sailing around on a ship, and that ship still exists as in San Francisco. Yeah, the other things that we can connect these with is actually the geography of the place. The Pacific Journal ends. He gets to Hawaii, and you're like, okay, we've arrived in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And then the Orison of Somni 451, they're told that when the souls of the, or when the, when the fabricants
after 12 years
of service, they attain, what is it, they attain
kind of retire
ascended, they're allowed to become self-aware, yeah, or ascended, and yeah, they get taken away on a boat to an island, and it's, yeah, kind of explained that that's Hawaii, they're,
yes,
taken away to Hawaii.
Yes,
not too many spoilers, turns out they're not really taken to Hawaii. What you're then left with,
which is also very, like, very similar, yeah, to the island.
Yeah, it's very similar to the island, of course, and every other clone.
Because they are going on a journey,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, they get taken away to Hawaii. But then in Sluice's Crossing and everything, yeah, after, where we talk to Zachary, he is on Hawaii. You know, so we've got those three linked with Hawaii there, and, yeah, they're going there, and of course the place where Adam Ewing is heading back to is San Francisco, and San Francisco is kind of like the fictionalized Buenos Aires, which is made even more clear in the movie, because at,
yes,
the end, because in the movie, Buenos Aires doesn't exist, it's just San Francisco, let's do San Francisco, and also the Pacific Journal of Adam Ewing ends in San Francisco, which means, yeah, that then in the movie, the Hawaii connection with Zachary isn't very clear. It's not clear that they're on Hawaii, because they decide to have San Francisco as the main connection there,
yes,
rather than Hawaii as the beginning and ending of the story, or, you know, the Pacific tribes being the,
yeah,
beginning,
right,
and the end. Then you have train travel in the Cavendish, Timothy Cavendish goes on a train journey.
Yeah,
to Hull, and the letters from Zegelheim have got a train journey.
He goes from England,
London
to
Belgium,
to Bruges, yeah,
to Bruges and things like that. So, yeah, the train journeys there, and yes, lots of journeys, lots of people going places.
I'm sure there are things we have not discovered.
Oh, loads and loads of connections.
It might be fun if Goodreads people could, like, if they have found something we
didn't
find.
I'm sure if we just read people's reviews that people will list connections. But the point is that what I enjoyed about this book is that there are so many of these connections.
Yes.
It's not just about the number six. It's not,
yeah,
just about music. It's not just about put them finding each other's stuff. Yeah, that's right. There you see. So there's so many connections there. That's the fun of it, is trying to bring it out. Now, of course, we're talking about slavery and stuff, but the other theme that I wanted to talk about is it real or not? Like, the whole idea is, like, which bits of it are real? Like, because they're all reading previous stories and are not quite sure, like, if you're reading a novel, it's obviously a novel,
yeah,
but then the idea is that the characters themselves aren't sure if the letters that they're reading from beforehand are real or not. What I find most interesting is the one person who doesn't have any questions about the authenticity of what she is reading is Louisa Ray, because she's reading personal letters to Sixsmith, who,
yes,
she knows is a real character,
real,
and she has no doubt at all that those other letters are actually real.
Yes.
However, Frobisher isn't sure that the journal he's reading is real.
Yes.
Timothy Cavendish reads this novel and is just presumes that it's a novel.
Yes.
Somni 451 watches a Hollywoodization of the story of Cavendish.
Yeah.
And then when Zachary watches the interview with Somni, he doesn't believe that's real either.
Yes.
He doesn't understand what's going on.
Right. Yes.
But he doesn't believe those old stories either. You know, so the only one who is 100% sure that what she is reading is true is the one that we are 100% sure isn't true, because it's told in a fictional city,
yes,
about a fictional person, about a fictional thing. And we know it's fictional because they're talking about nuclear fusion. You know,
yeah,
that can...
For example, like, the story of Sun Mi was at some point when I realized where it took place, because, I mean, it says here...
Neo-Seoul.
Neo-Seoul is in the movie. In the book, this is called...
Oh, Neo-Seoul Corporos.
Which is an invented city.
Yes.
But then, in the end, they go to Busan.
Yes.
Which is actually a Korean city.
You've been there.
I've been there.
Yeah.
Yay. Yeah. It was a choir Olympics there.
Yeah.
And so that was the point when I knew, oh, actually, that is actually on...
A real place. Yeah.
Of course. I mean, Louisa, yeah, Ray's story very much reminded of San Francisco, although,
yeah,
it is called different.
Yeah.
And also what's really interesting is that the Chatham Islands, where they
The begin, it
at
all
the beginning,
yeah.
Where they're starting, that is actually also a real place.
Yes, that's what I'm saying, is that the only one that we know is totally fictional. That can't be true.
Yeah.
But what I want to say is that the whole idea is it true or not, or which parts of this are true or not?
Yeah.
I think kind of fails, it's one of these same things is that we're talking about Jesus or Moses or these other characters where you go, well, did Moses really exist? No. I mean, there's just no way that Moses... There's no evidence at all outside of ancient myths that Moses exists. Jesus. Did Jesus exist? Oh, lots of people say he does exist. Lots of people say... Oh, it does. You know. People say he did exist. Some people think that Jesus was a historical figure. Other people think he was a mythical figure who was later historicized. You know, like Hercules was... Like, back in the ancient world, people would say, well, when did Hercules live? Oh, he must have lived around about here. And now we're going, but Hercules was a fake person. But people were actually trying to place Hercules in history.
Yeah.
In... 100 AD, or around that kind of time. The point of these scriptures and these ancient myths, their power doesn't come from the fact if they are true or not. It comes from the symbolism and how they help us talk about the world, yeah. And how it talks about ethics and morality and society and spirituality and all these other things. The point, if they're true or not, is literally beside the point. Like, no Jew who discovers that Moses probably wasn't a historical figure or Abraham wasn't a historical figure, none of them suddenly go, ah, well, Judaism is worthless. I'm not going to be a Jew anymore. I want my foreskin back. Nobody, none of them think that, you know.
Want my foreskin back.
Yeah, no, but that's no religious people like who actually have the religion as their identity in that way, just because they discover that something didn't happen. Like no Christian who goes, oh, creation wasn't, oh, dinosaurs weren't around at the same, oh, there's evolution, ah, like that. Of course there are these, like, you know, young earth creationists who really stick by it, but the vast majority of Christians aren't young earth creationists, but they still find meaning in those stories that are applicable to them. And I think a discussion of this book for us, of course it's all fiction, but us trying to separate out what we think should be fiction or what we think should be considered the unreal parts. It's like, which part of this is real and which part of it isn't? Like, what is the truth and what is it? I don't care about that. I don't want to know about that. When I'm watching these movies, we're at the end of The Matrix or at the end of this, you know, at the end of Inception, it's like, was it all a dream going through? Of course, that's what the story is about in the Inception. But there's a lot of these movies and they're going, well, was it all real? Was it all not real and things?
What is reality?
Yeah, what is reality? In a fictional book, I am 100% fine with considering every single thing in the book is fiction.
Yeah.
Like, and the author intends all of it to be regarded as fiction. And I think this book is genius in that the people in the book are telling us, this is probably fiction.
Yeah.
Like, there is no... And the only time, like I say, this is the only time that we're not told blatantly that it is actually real...
Six Smith's letters,
yeah. Which happen in the one which is most blatantly the fiction.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
So.
What was your favorite part? Did you have a favorite part?
One second. I'm just having a quick drink of tea there. My favorite parts changed as I was reading the book, which I think is really important as well, because when I started off, I thought Adam Ewing's journey was great. I mean, and also I've sailed around the Pacific quite a bit, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've not been to Chatham Island, but I've sailed, you know, via Tahiti and New Zealand and New Caledonia and Polynesian, like Papua New Guinea and all these. No, I've sailed around those places, so for me, it's fascinating to actually, you know, to see that kind of thing, and to like sail. You know, I noticed that. Oh, and now we're sailing up to Hawaii, and they reach Hawaii, and they're talking about Cook going to Hawaii, and talking about this island, and that island. And I was like, yes, I know. You know, I've sailed these routes myself. So though I understand why some people might find that a bit boring and historical and a bit dry, so that was good. Robert Frobisher's story I thought was really good because, like, I am a musician and it's not that, oh, I'm going to be writing the greatest work of art, but I do also understand that those kind of trials and tribulations of making work and not being appreciated for work and doing this and doing that and going, oh, now this is going to be my life's work and this and that. So I thought his story was really good. And also, I've been to Bruges, so that part of Belgium as well, so I had a lot of fun, you know, him going across this path, this bit of... you know, he goes to a park and goes in here and there. You know, I just like that kind of European adventure kind of thing.
Yeah.
Louisa Ray, I didn't like the first part of it or the second part of it. It's not that I didn't think it was well written. It's just that style of literature that he's copying
yours.
There. It's just not really me. And it comes down to it as well. Like there's some Alistair Reynolds novels where he writes in the style. Like he does his take on like Terminal World is his take on Mars science fiction, and this is his take on this kind of science fiction. This is his take on this kind of thing. And he wrote one called Century Rain, which is his take on just a few kinds of science fiction and also like the pulp detective noir novel.
Yeah.
Which I just like the style of science fiction that he's doing a takeoff on there. I don't like, and also the style of literary fiction, like the mystery novel kind of thing. I didn't like either. So of course I'm going to come off like not enjoying that.
That so much, yeah.
And that's the thing that happens here with the Louisa Ray mystery. It never grabbed me. I was never that interested.
Yeah.
I didn't care about the conspiracy or the fusion or anything like that. Ghastly Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish, I thought was very good fun. And again, it's meant to be comic. It's like it says, the fourth story is comic in tone. And yes, and I totally understand going to Hull. I got my degree from Hull University in Scarborough. Because the university I went to in Scarborough turned into Hull University Scarborough campus instead
of really?
Scarborough University, yeah. So I know that kind of part of the world as well.
Have you been there as well?
I've been to Hull, yeah. So I know that kind of area.
Oh, okay.
And I've taken train journeys in the UK and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of stuff that I liked about that. The Orison of Somebody 451, I thought was good science fiction, interesting science fiction, but again, it's nothing that I haven't read before. And then when I first started listening to the audiobook of the Zachary section, Sluice's Crossing and everything after, which is right in the middle of the book, I got about 15 minutes into it and was just like, oh, and just fell asleep because I couldn't concentrate.
Yeah.
And then the next time I tried listening to it, I just couldn't concentrate and just couldn't get into it. And I was like, and I couldn't work out what's going on. I was like, oh, okay, we're back on a tribe and we're doing this. And then about a third of the way through that section, something clicked in my brain because that's the longest bit because that's like all, it doesn't get a break.
Yeah.
And then halfway through, I was like, this is amazing. The audiobook reading of it was great. The language was fascinating. Everything was going there. And it was a real, like, post-apocalypse. They go to the top of the big island, the mountain, and they go up to the Manukia Observatories. Again, it's fascinating, that journey
up. They actually exist.
Yes, of course they actually exist.
Holy shit.
Didn't you know that?
No.
I've
never been to Hawaii.
No, it's not. Well, I've never been to that island of Hawaii. But, you know, that's they're the very famous observatories up there. And anyway, I thought that was fascinating. And then as we went back through the stories, I enjoyed all of the stories more as they were completed. But I think that's a great way of that you get, like, as you read through, you get five setups and then a story and then six, and then five payoffs, if you know what I mean. And the payoffs I thought were very good.
Definitely.
And in the end, I think the bit that I didn't like on the second half, as much as the first half, is the Orison of Somni 451, because the ending of that is in the same kind of vein of conspiracy, which I didn't find interesting again, if you know what I mean. And as we go back, the Ghastly Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish is the prison break kind of section was good fun, and going back through, I thought was all really good. So my favourite, I think, is the central of the book. But then as I went back through, I really enjoyed the end of
Cavendish.
I think the end of Frobisher's story I thought was the best ending. Yeah. And then Adam Ewing's tied it all together again. It's like, yes, there's a self-freed man. Now I'm going to fight slavery instead of be a slave. You know, instead of doing this estate with slave stuff myself, I'm going to fight against that.
I think my favourite story in the book was also was Frobisher.
Yeah.
Just because this is so nice, so good to read. Obviously, David Mitchell has a bit of knowledge about music. And when I read the book, I had so much music in my head when I read it.
Yeah.
Because they were composing this, what was it called? Dead Bird. The Death Bird. That was the big piece that Frobisher was living with heirs that he composed with and for him.
And it was a takeoff on German music, a deconstruction of German music of the time.
And this is all comes together. The Vivian Ayres reminded me so much of like a cross of between Debussy Achilles, Debussy, and Ravel, because this is the kind of style that kind of created in my head.
Yeah, we were just at dinner time. We were just listening to some Ravel music, and we're like, "This is the amazing."
And this is so awesome that by just having read something, some words to you, which are because I listened to the audiobook. You mean David Mitchell managed to describe the music that was composed there so well that I had it in my head, even though there was never played any music played or anything. Mm-hmm. I had it in my head, it's just a really beautiful storytelling as well. Mm. And
his story, yeah, okay.
Of course, because he's a musician, he's the closest to me. Yeah. So, and then...
As someone who is in now your sixth year of music university.
Stop it.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying.
It's good. Yeah. I'm getting a very profound training in what I do.
Yeah.
So, the second thing, I think the second one that I would put like on the second place would be Cavendish, because that's just so much fun to read. And then after that, maybe it's Ewing. And I think for me, the least enjoyable actually was Zachary's part.
Oh, really?
Because this is so cruel. This is so, so...
You should see it in the movie.
This is so cruel and so, like, back to the roots of human evil...
Yeah.
Evil-tum, I don't know how do you call it.
Human nature.
Mean.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So mean to each other. Like, of course, it's like totally what they started with at the beginning,
like
with
the Maori
and Moriori.
Because
there's this one tribe that loves peace, and there's this one tribe which just kills people.
But the whole point of that is it's only when the white people come in who go, oh, now let's mix these two people together and see what happens, you know?
Yeah,
it's,
of course.
That's the point, it sets off with the slave trade, you know, that whole thing is like sparked off by the slave trade. Even though they're cannibals, like almost kind of peace-loving cannibals, although it's a weird thing, like I'm never quite sure what's going on there.
And also because I really enjoyed the bit in Adam Ewing where it's where the slave or the free slave who actually freed himself, this is something I didn't like in the movie. Maybe we talk about that.
Let's just talk quickly about the audiobook from Audible, and then because I'll do it.
I can't really tell about this because I haven't listened to the English one.
No, but I just wanted to say that like I do have a sponsorship or like there's a promotion that I do with audible.com. But if you go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, you can get a free book, and you might as well get Cloud Atlas because it's really good. It's 19 hours and 33 minutes long, and each one of these stories is narrated by a different person. Scott Brick, who I've had audiobooks by him, he's a very good audiobook narrator. Cassandra Campbell, Kim My Guest, Kirby Hayborn, John Lee, who we know from The Prefect. Lots of other
Very Alice enjoyable. Ramels,
and then Richard Matthews. I just clicked on Cassandra Campbell's name. I'm not sure if I've listened to her. I've heard her do something. Yeah, she's done Ender books by Ender in Exile, Cloud Atlas. Maybe I thought I recognised the name, so maybe I've listened to another one of hers. Anyway, very good readings and really brings it to life as well. Like, in some ways, like if I had to sit down and read this book, like to get through some of it, I would be skimming. I would be going too quickly, I think.
Yeah.
Whereas this, I really enjoyed it, and the Zachary section in the middle part was great. So anyway, if you want this audiobook or any one of 150,000 others, you can go to sfbrp.com. Go to sfbrp.com and you can click on a link which will take you to the right page. And the right page will be audibletrial.com/sfbrp. And in going there, you can support the SFBRP. And I have no problem promoting Audible because I would be promoting Audible even if they weren't giving me money, because the audiobooks are awesome and you might as well get them from Audible because that's the best deal generally. So let's move on to the movie because I think we've covered the book and then
how far are we into now?
It's we've been going an hour. Yeah, so let's finish. Yeah. Let's talk for 10 minutes about the movie and I don't, again, we can contrast them as well because lots of people said, oh, just watch the trailer for the movie, then read the book, and then don't bother watching the movie. And I've heard conflicting reports about this movie. And now I'm not sure why why the conflicting reports are there.
Yes.
Because if you, I totally understand, if you have not read this book and you watch the movie, I 100% understand if you watch it, go, well, that was long, boring and confusing. What was all that about?
Yes.
Let's not bother with that again. And let's not even bother with the book. However, having read the book and then watching the movie, I really enjoyed the movie as, not so much as a movie, because I think it's flawed as a movie. Like, if as a standalone movie, I'm not sure how much it would work, like how accessible it is or how easy it is to watch or anything.
Yeah.
Like. Well, even accessible and easy to watch, just how enjoyable it'd be to watch if you've not read the book. I don't want to defend it on that level. But what I really loved about the movie is it was like having a book club discussion. Like,
yes.
These guys, like, there's three directors, plus probably a screenwriter or whatever. There's a few screenwriters. Although I think they did the screenwriting themselves as well. The Wachowskis and Tom Tykwer, or something like that, German director. And so it's like these guys and girls. I was going to say guys. They're not guys.
Yes. Guys and girls.
One of the Wachowski brothers has a sex change. Is now Lana Wachowski. So anyway, so I can't call them guys. Anyway, these directors and writers and these filmmakers and editors have read this book and they're going, well, what do we think the book is about? What do we think the connection between these characters are? What
and
do we
how
think?
How can we make it so it fits as
yeah,
a
like,
movie?
What scenes should we put together? Because all of these scenes, as you're reading the book, you're making the connection between these characters. Like, for example, in the Letters from Zerheim, Vivian Ayres says, oh, I had a dream. I had a dream about a woman. I had a dream about a restaurant underground, and all of the waitresses had exactly the same face. And when you're reading that in the first section, you're like, okay, whatever, it was a dream. And then when you read the Somni 451, you're like, oh, Somni 451 is in a restaurant underground with a dome with clouds on it over the top. And that all of the faces look the same because they're all the same. So when you watch it, like when you read it in the book, you have to make those connections yourself. And there are many of these connections.
Yes.
There are a lot of these connections that you have to make and can make. You know, like the name, like just like the names with Six Myths, the A to Z, the Somni 451, which is the Fahrenheit 451 connection. There's loads of these kind of things going on there. In the movie, they're like, which of these characters and which of these scenes should put together? Because it doesn't just go, you know, first half of the first story, first half of the second story, first half. It doesn't. There's just scenes and shots just skipping back and forth.
Yeah.
You can skip to someone and see like 4 or 5 seconds of someone just looking at something or walking down a street, and then you're cutting away and you're onto a different story.
Yeah.
Very, very experimental, amazing structure.
Yes.
But it was like watching these directors and writers going, what do we think the connections are? And me and Juliana are going, oh, look at this. That's what they think. Oh, I made that same connection. Like, instead of me having to remember the dream of Vivian Ayres and connecting it in this way, they just, like, after showing all these clones with the same faces, it cuts back to this guy going, oh, and I had a dream. And the music in the dream, and it was in a restaurant with the photo. And it's like, well, that really lays it all out. So it's kind of like a compressed version of 3 or 4 people's views of what the book is about, which is like 50% of what they thought the book was about covered, like, overlapped with what I thought.
Yeah.
But
I had 3 points or something that weren't really
that you didn't like so much.
But otherwise, it was really good. And I think we should come to the main point why this movie was so enjoyable.
What's that?
Do you get it? It's the
acting.
The actors.
Yeah.
So in the book, you have the main cast. Let me just go there. You have Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Jim Broadbent, Hugo Weaving.
Weaving.
Yeah.
Jim Sturgis.
Duna Bay, Ben Whishaw.
James Darcy. Those are the main ones, really. Yeah.
And then Susan
Sarandon. And Hugh Grant as well.
And Hugh Grant.
Yeah.
And it is hilarious because you have, like, the main cast of, like, Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Hugh Grant, and Jim Broadbent.
There's
Hugo Weaving.
But
they appear in all of these stories.
Yes.
And
all of them appear in all of the stories.
All of them appear in all of, not all of those in the same stories, but you have a connection of the actors, which is a totally different level of connection making in the
yes.
movie itself, the connection of the actors appearing in the other person's story.
Yeah.
For example, you have who was this?
Well, let me put it this way: there's some characters who never play the main character. For example, Susan Susan Sarandon, she's always just like an older woman, like side person. Character. Hugh Grant always plays one of the bad guys. He plays the Reverend Giles Horrocks, the Hotel Heavy, Lloyd Hooks, Denham Cavendish. You know, he's always like the bad guy, and I never really seen Hugh Grant as a bad guy in anything.
No, never.
And he's really good.
Always in all his movies, he's just playing Hugh Grant.
Yeah, he's Hugh Grant. He's the foppish guy. In this, he's really. Like, I mean, it looks like he's bigger and heavier.
Yeah.
Like, when he's in that kind of Maori makeup with the skull's pace.
Yeah, the kruna.
And he's like, you look at him and just go, oh, I don't like
I'm
it.
Scared.
Like that. Yeah.
I'm scared.
And also Hugo Weaving, who is, you know, you were like, who's Hugo Weaving? And I was like, Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, Mr. Anderson.
He's Agent Smith.
Yeah.
He's Agent Smith, and he's always a bad guy as well.
Yeah.
And, but those two, like, those are the main characters who never have. Like, they're never one of the main characters as we read them as the narrators in the book.
You meet them in every story.
Yes.
It's a different kind of character.
Yeah, whereas Tom Hanks is Zachary, but also sometimes plays a good guy and sometimes plays a bad guy or sometimes just plays an incidental character.
Oh, it's Isaac Zacks,
yeah.
And
Halle Berry always plays a good person, or not always plays a good person, she's always there. You know, Jim Broadbent, if there's an old character, old man character, he's there. He's Timothy Cavendish, but also he's Vivian Ayres. Those are his two main roles, I guess. But it is amazing that these connections are made. Now, one thing I want to point out, one big difference between the book and the novel, is that in the novel, none of the characters are shown to be, except Louisa Ray, none of them are shown to be particularly nice people all the way through. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, for example, taking it backwards, like, Zachary is shown at the beginning to be a coward who gets his father killed just because he's a coward and is a bit of an idiot and he's suspicious and stuff like that. I mean, he's a fun character and you like him by the end, but,
Never really liked him.
But, like, for example, Timothy Cavendish is really racist. Like, and that doesn't come across in the movie. In the movie, he's like this bumbling fool who is like, well, you know, it's really bad, and his brother got him into this. No, you like in the book, he probably really screwed over a lot of people.
Yeah,
and really was really racist about it. And once he got there, was really quite unpleasant. The reason why it's so fun to read is because it's fun to have such an unpleasant guy learning his lesson. You know, like getting his comeuppance, learning his lesson, and coming out the other side a changed person. Whereas in the movie, it was like, oh, he's an old guy who does this. And he never really, like, it was fun. His journey he went on was fun, but that journey that he took wasn't, like, a big character journey. And,
But Sonmi did not really, she's just a...
More
innocent.
Yeah, she's more innocent. It's more of, like, it's more of her story which goes through a change, like, her position and her role as being a messiah figure. Yeah, and also the musician guy, Frobisher, is... You know, he's a crook. He robs people
He's a young guy who's a bit
cheats on people, cuckolds people. Wants to.
I never really understood why, like how, like the letters he writes to Sixsmith.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're so like
personal.
No, they are not really. They are really bad.
Like honest, you mean?
No, they're a bit. Like how he's talking to Sixsmith sometimes make me think, well, why is this guy even writing back? Obviously, because Frobisher is not really respectful.
No.
Towards Sixsmith.
Yeah, he's not a nice guy. And it's the same with Adam Ewing at the beginning. He's like for a lot of the book, he's super racist. Of course, by the end, he's like, I'm not gonna go. You know, I'm going to be an abolitionist. You know, in the movie, they pretty much say, I'm going to be an abolitionist. But all the way through, you know who's going to be a nice guy.
Yeah.
You know, and Tom Hanks' character, you know, no, I say Tom Hanks. Let me say Zachary, all the way through, you know he's going to be the hero in the end.
Yeah.
And he's not going to do anything bad. Anyway, I just thought that was a big change in the book, that a lot of the bad characters were kind of, like, taken up by Hugh Grant and Hugo Weaving. Some of their functionality was actually part of the characters.
Absorb the bad.
Yeah, they kind of absorb the main character, the bad things of the main characters, to leave the main characters to be better in the movie, which is fine. I understand that they've got to restrict a whole lot down. So, what else do you think about the movie compared to the book?
I just can't point out enough the fun I had seeing the actors appearing in different roles, because they played all in different masks. And the masks were sometimes so well done that I did not see them at the first point.
Yeah, when I first pointed out that the doctor was like the doctor in the Adam Ewing section was Tom Hanks, and you're like, yeah. Oh, that's Tom Hanks. And I said, and look, there's Hugh Grant as well. And you're like, what?
What?
Yeah, Hugh Grant.
And it's brilliant. It's really good. It's so well made.
There were two spots where the makeup, the prosthetics don't really work. Once is that Hugh Grant has got this old man face on, and he's lying down, and you can see that when they applied the old man face, he was sitting upright, and so his face should be drooping downwards, but then he lays down and his face doesn't kind of sag back horizontal, like the gravity is pulling at 90 degrees to where it should be. And yes. So there's one or two points where you think, well, that's
fine. But also the factory worker who's supposed to be a Mexican worker.
And she's Korean.
She looks so Asian. And then out of her is this nasty Spanish language coming, which doesn't even sound slightly Spanish.
Yeah, but most of the time it works really well. There are a few times. But in a way, what I liked about it is that, like, again, it's what they've done is like, okay, the book is very playful. The book wants you to make these connections yourself.
Yeah.
Like, how can we do that? If this would have been done with every single character having a unique actor, it would be much worse of a movie. You may be thinking, is this a gimmick? Like the characters in the book are going, is this a gimmick? And when you're watching the movie, you're going, is this a gimmick? But no, because at the very end, Adam Ewing meets his stepfather, that's played by Hugo Weaving, the very end, who's meant to be a bad guy. And this character, his father-in-law, has quite a bit of screen time. It's kind of like a pivotal moment in the movie where they're saying, we are going to stand up against tyranny. We're going to stand up against slavery. We're going to stand up against forced servitude.
Yeah.
In a way, it's quite crucial in the movie. And if they'd have just got any character to play that, you'd be like, well, what's this guy doing? Like, it's like the end of the movie, the more recent King Kong movie. The guy who gets the final words is just a newspaper reporter with a camera who just flashes, like, well, what's going on here? Oh, it's just King Kong is just a big dumb beast. And I was like, how did he earn the final words?
Yeah.
In the novel? It's like Psycho as well. The guy who has the main scene at the end is just this psychologist who comes in and goes, well, the reason for this is this, and this, you know. And you're like, wow, that's a bit weird. Like, who's this guy who suddenly comes in and has the climactic scene?
Because in this movie,
we've seen Hugo Weaving all the way through.
And we've seen that this is another level in this movie to show the different levels.
Yeah.
So in the end, it is kind of like, it makes sense to have characters reappear in other people's story and say important words.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is, in this case, for the final piece, it only works because we know this character thematically from the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought it was a genius book and a genius movie. I think it's a better book than a movie. But as movies go, I'm really pleased I watched it because it's movie making in a way that I've not seen before.
Yes, definitely.
It's a retelling of a book in a way which is I've not seen. Actually, no, I've seen similar things before. I just think it's the best executed and it looks gorgeous. I mean, the movie making is great.
And
the
acting is
great.
It's so fun because when you told me that it's a German movie, I didn't believe
made
it.
Made in Berlin. Well, Potsdam, just outside of Berlin.
And so also there's several German like B-level actors appearing, which I noticed.
Yeah, who probably live in Berlin and went down to Potsdam to work on extras on these scenes.
Yeah, that's really good fun. And Tom Tykwer is a good. He is also a good director.
Yeah, he did Run Lola Run.
Yeah, he did, and which also was one of the German movies that was successful out of Germany as well. And and I just looked it up. It is the most
expensive independent
movie. It was like $100 million.
Yeah.
Which before that,
you can see it on screen. You can see it's $100 million.
Perfume.
Yeah.
That was the first. That was for a long time. That was the most expensive German movie. Which was also very successful outside of Germany. And then it's this one, which was also successful, but in the United States, not so much.
Well, the point
but
is,
but in China, a lot. It played in a lot
of. Is what it says here on Wikipedia.
Yeah, it said in Wikipedia in China it played in a lot, and in Russia as well.
Yeah.
So in the end, I think it did make its money. But
the thing is, it didn't get any Oscars, and the reason why it didn't get Oscars is because it's a big Hollywood-looking movie. Financed and made in Germany, and you think like and by German, well, not all by Germans, like German crews and things like that. But you're of course, Hollywood is probably not going to reward a movie like this, which is this experimental and this foreign,
yes,
in it as an English language movie. It's fine if it was all in German, they'd be like, oh yes, this is the most amazing
the
German
foreign, yeah.
Yeah, it would win the best, it would best been the best picture in another language,
yeah,
or whatever, in a foreign,
yeah,
language. But
no,
it's not going to win, it's not going to win rewards awards for acting and stuff,
yeah.
Anyway, but the thing is,
I would...
I'm not sure if it should do, because I, as a film, if I'd seen it without watching the book,
yes,
I don't know how good of a movie it,
yeah,
would have been. So
read the book first, or listen to the audiobook first,
yeah,
and then watch the movie, and you will enjoy it probably half as much. No, double as much. No.
Okay, so yeah. I just want to finish off in slight spoiler territory here at the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, it's not
we
so much that.
I just wanted
to talk about, it's like the connections between these last two stories. We had different ideas of what was going on at the end. Putting aside what they did in the movie, which I thought was quite good. They did actually change a lot in the movies. I don't want to get into all of the changes here.
They wrapped up the stories in different ways,
yeah,
than it was made in the book.
But in Merinim, in Zachary's story, Merinim is the one with the starship, the comet shaped birthmark and,
yeah,
stuff. And it wasn't him. But what I was always thinking, the thing that I was not sure of the connections with, is like, sure, they had fusion in Buenos Aires or whatever it was,
yeah,
and they were making fusion there in the time of Somni 451, the ship was powered by fusion, like the ship they had fusion power there,
yeah,
and it was fusion powered with the ship that they go to at the end, where the fabricants go to be taken away to Hawaii,
yeah,
is what they say, or taken away to a Pacific island,
yeah.
And then at the end Zachary turns up, and the ship that comes along to visit with the Prescians, with the old ones, not the old ones, but like the people who still have technology,
yeah.
And there they were saying, well, we are the ones with the old ones, we're the ones with technology, well, we made our skin different colour.
Mm.
They say that. And so I was thinking, at the end, are the Prescients, are they meant to be fabricants who are recreating themselves on this fusion? You know, do they live?
Yeah.
Is this prescient ship?
Yeah.
Is this a fusion? Is this fusion powered prescient ship? Are they recreating themselves? Is that the reason why they live a lot longer? Is because they make themselves better? They change their skin. They change themselves, and they are the literal descendants of Somni 451. Or I was thinking, are the people on the Big Island, are they prescients who are now breeding? Because those are the ones who honor Somni 451 as a god, and they don't live very long. And I'm thinking, well, why do they live to 30-year-old, and when they're 30, why is 30 considered really old,
yeah,
at that time? Why are they old age when they're 30? Is it because they are the fabricants? And
can I answer to that?
Yes, go for it.
I think that they die when they are 30,
yeah,
is supposed to show that at that point, the society went so far back in its development,
like after the fall.
After the fall, that humanity was taken back to what's Neanderthals, kind of not that same level.
Yeah.
But this kind of it went back so low that it was like middle aged kind of.
Yes, I understand
society.
That.
And in middle age, or is that how it's called?
Medieval,
whatever. That is the time when people had not a good supply of food and all the other things. This is,
yeah,
why they didn't live so long.
And
I think this is a showing back that if after a fallout, humanity
will regress. Yeah. The thing is with that, I'm always a bit confused about, is that life expectancy counts everybody. But the point is with life expectancy is if you get past 10 years old, you're probably going to live until you're 50 or something like that. That's just the way it works, that like now people live a lot longer into old age, but it used to be that like most people would die before they were 2 years old, and then of those other people, most people would die before they're 10 years old, but then,
yeah,
once you get past that time,
don't you remember that when in the book that Zachary has these different love affairs,
yeah,
and he actually one of them she gets pregnant,
yeah,
and
but
the
then
baby
the
that,
baby comes out.
The baby that comes out, it has no mouth and no.
Yes, so, but I was wondering, is that because of the fall, or is that because they are the children of fabricants?
No,
and
I
copies
don't
of copies
I don't
work.
I don't
okay.
think they are fabricants.
Well, anyway, I was wondering, are are the Prescients the descendants of Fabricants, or are Zachary's people?
I don't think the Prescients
are. Yeah, but it's too, for me, it's like too much of a connection that they say, oh, and the Fabricants are taken to Hawaii when they did. And then at the end of it, you get these two levels of things, and some of them praise Somni as a historic savior, and the other ones are talking about how they've changed their bodies in the past and live on a fusion ship. Anyway, maybe it's just me. I just wanted to mention that at the end here, because that's one of those things that I think is very much open to interpretation about this.
It is. All the connections you can make or not.
Yes. Anyway, that's a connection that I was more interested in. But then I said, oh, I'm not interested in the truth. But in this case, that's a mystery. It's not like, and it turns out the truth is. Anyway, so let's finish this up. We've gone on way too long. Now. Well, not way too long. I guess when we do these discussions.
We have done two reviews. Yeah. One, and I think 1.5 hours is okay. Is okay.
So you're going to give a rating to the book?
Yeah. I was thinking very hard about it. And also when I already rated it on Goodreads.
Yeah.
I gave it 4 stars. And I think I would stick with it. Because it has two sides. It has the brilliant writing and the brilliant storytelling. And this whole setup is very good.
Yeah.
But then also it has periods, of course, which is very personal, which is very subjective. Some things that I just didn't really enjoy.
Yeah, you get to like
The secondary part was very hard for me. So that was, I can't really give it, I would give it 4.5 stars if I could.
Yeah.
Why
wouldn't you?
But on Goodreads you can't.
Oh, so what would you give it? Because in Science Fiction Book Review Podcast you can give any number.
Oh yeah, then I give it 4.5 stars.
Okay.
I think that's a good
way of seeing it. Well, I think I will agree with you. I'd give it 4.5 stars because there are sections of it which I do think are flawed. There are big bits where I just go, I could have done without that in the book, like the Louisa Ray. Like, Louisa Ray mysteries could have either been better written or just left out for me.
But of course, that's the personal point of the book. You have 6 different kinds of stories.
Yeah.
And of course, you will have at least one which you don't really... can't really stick with it, which is just natural, and I can't really put it as a negative, but I have to put it as a tiny bit of enjoy it.
It's not going to get 5 star. This is nowhere a 5-star book for me, because 5 stars for me comes down to personal enjoyment. And unless a book makes me cry or weep or or changes my life in some way or something like that, it's not going to get 5 stars. And this book, I really enjoyed it, but maybe I'll give it 4 stars. Yeah, I think actually for me 4 stars.
Come on, 4.5 is worth it.
Okay, let's give it four. We'll both give it 4.5 stars. That means on average between it, we'll get 4.5 stars. So yes. Anyway, so that's it for this one and the movie too. I can't rate the movie because it's like a book adaptation. But then if you think about, we talked about other movies too. We talked about Solaris and the two movies of Solaris. The first one that we watched, the Tarkovsky one, which that felt like, here's a guy who's read the book, and now I'm having a book discussion with him of what he thought was important in the book.
Yeah.
And then the Soderbergh version, which we watched, and we're just like, what the hell was that? That wasn't Did he even read it? Didn't even read the book, you know? And this is very, the Cloud Atlas movie is very much more along the Tarkovsky vein of filmmaking, which is like, hey, we are making a film.
Not as much cineastic.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Oh, no, but still, there's still a lot of stuff going on.
There's still stuff going on, but way more blockbuster style movie.
But it isn't a blockbuster. The thing is,
it is not a blockbuster, but for German, kind
of. Let me put it this way. It has the look of a blockbuster. Yes. It has an A-list, it has like a super A-list cast.
Yes.
But it really is an independent movie. And even though it costs $100 million, it's very much an independent movie.
Yeah, it is.
Like, independently controlled,
it's
independently
experimental.
Produced. Experimental. Yes. Anyway. So, that's it. So you can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge on Twitter. You can read my blog. I'm blogging at lukeburge.com/blog. And also read my fiction, which you can find at lukeburge.com too. You can become my friend and Juliana's friend on goodreads.com. And then we can see what you think of Cloud Atlas. For example, Jenny rated it 5 stars. Awesomematic rated it 3 stars. Brian, 5. Yeah, lots of people rated it. Oh,
yeah, Isabel rated it 4 stars as well.
Elaine DeWitt, 1 star.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a pity.
I would just come right and say it. I don't get it. The thing is...
Oh, yeah, that's the point. Yeah. If you don't get it, it's difficult.
Yeah.
You should give it another try.
You don't have to give it another try. There's some people who just don't want to do this kind of stuff. Ronald rated it 1 star. I gave up as this story is just not for me. Return to the library so someone else has a chance. Yeah, I understand that. Anyway, lots of 5 stars. Anyway, we rated it 4.5 stars. Our friends, or my friends, so pretty much SFBRP people rated it 4 stars. So it is a very highly rated and well-regarded book. It didn't win the Nebula Award.
Oh, well.
Let me just look up who won that year. I've got a feeling it's like Harry Potter or something. Here we go. What
2004.
Okay, let's go down here. So in 2004, Louis McMaster Bijold, the Paladin of Souls. We read her as well. I'm kind of giving up on her.
Not this one,
but we'll get to them as well. Yes, Cory Doctorow, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, Jack McDevitt, David Mitchell, Cloud Atlas, Sean Stewart, Perfect Circle, and June Wolfe, The Knight. I have only read Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. Cloud Atlas is, well, just
it's
listen.
Too,
just
too good for Nebula.
Let me put it this way. Just listen to my review of Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, and you'll understand what this kind of thing that goes between them. So, right, that's it from me. And Juliana, say goodbye, Juliana.
Yeah, goodbye. Not to me, but
yeah, say
to
the listeners. Juliana, say goodbye. Say goodbye, comma, Juliana.
What are you saying?
Juliana, comma. How about you say goodbye to all the people who are listening?
Goodbye, all the people that are listening.
Okay, we'll get there in the end. Bye, and I'll catch you next time.